From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Poverty in America on Thanksgiving Day. Hello again, I'm Orman Alney, and this is an archived edition of To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Parts of the United States are as poor as the third world. That's according to a recent United Nations report on global inequality. Any doubts about poverty in America were erased by the plight of New Orleans, where 30% live below the official poverty line. On To the Point, whatever happened to Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty? Have massive government programs instituted by Democrats failed to deliver? Or have they been eviscerated by Republican cuts in taxes and spending? What does race have to do with it? On Reporter's Notebook, later on, the Latin Republic of the United States. First up, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney back with an archived edition of To the Point. Hurricane Katrina ripped bare the face of poverty in the United States. On To the Point, did the Democrats' war on poverty fail to deliver? Or have Republican tax and spending cuts made it ineffective? We'll talk about that and ask, what's the role of race in American poverty? On Reporter's Notebook, we'll hear more about the Spanish-speaking parallel nation of 35 million people right here in the United States. And speaking of Katrina, one part-time resident of New Orleans is Harry Shearer, musician, actor, writer, host of Le Show on public radio. He has been visiting the house that he loves in the city that he loves. And Harry, good to have you with us today.
Thanks, Warren. Good to be with you.
When you first went back, you wrote about, very eloquently, I might add, the Thanks. Sound of silence. Tell us about that and if you still hear it.
Well, I mean, the New Orleans is a city that, for me, where I live, is marked by a couple of distinctive sounds. There's an out-of-tune calliope that plays on the riverboat that sits in the Mississippi, and then there's this sort of major sixth train whistle that goes behind us. And that, you know, in addition to the birds and the street musicians, sort of marks the soundscape of the place just on an average day. And now there are this whole swath of the city where well, first of all, you don't hear the riverboat. It's not operating. You don't hear the streetcars. They're in their barns rusting away. All you hear is that train. There are a few birds at this point, and because a lot of trees have died. And there are whole swaths of town where you don't see or hear a single human.
And on the way, you described being on the plane and being at the airport and the kind of expectation and excitement there used to be among people that were traveling to New Orleans. You found something very different.
Yeah, there's always a sort of a notable exuberance in a plane full of people that's headed to New Orleans, like the party has already begun on the plane going down there and continues on the plane coming back. And this plane full coming from Chicago was almost uniformly quiet, as if they were anticipating or dreading what they were on the way to see. And it stayed very quiet the entire flight, especially when we got within viewing distance of New Orleans, when every single neck craned to look out the window and see what they could see, which was basically the sea of blue-tarped roofs below. And the other thing I noticed, which got me a little bit of criticism at the Huffington Post from a couple of readers, was unavoidable. This was the first plane flight I'd ever been on to New Orleans where the entire passenger load was white.
Wow. What does that tell you about who's still there and who's liable to be there in the next weeks and months?
Well, it tells you that there's a great deal of concern in New Orleans that the city is having its demographics changed, maybe for good, maybe, I shouldn't use those words, maybe forever, or for the foreseeable future, the evacuees. You do see at the mayor's town meetings, which I've seen one of in New Orleans, you do see an awful lot of evacuees, African-American evacuees, who have by one way or another gotten back down to New Orleans from far-flung parts of the diaspora to tell the mayor face-to-face, I want to come back, we all want to come back, this is our home, but there's no place to live. Even though there are plenty of now hiring signs hanging out in front of every restaurant and hotel in the city, It's clear that there's no place for people to live if they take those jobs.
Again, we're talking with Harry Shearer, part-time resident of New Orleans. Well, who do you see on the streets in New Orleans, in the restaurants and elsewhere when you walk around?
You see some locals in the French Quarter. There's a large community of locals that never left or that came back, belying the reputation of the place just as a tourist district. You see small business owners who have been able to reopen much more quickly than the large national chains. You see some of the, I guess the only word would be freaks, the people who were in New Orleans because it was the only place in the South that wouldn't rouse them away. You see very few African Americans. You do see some. And I was in a club watching a musical performance the first night I was there, and it was a club full of African Americans, a jazz club, and I was interested in who those people were, and they turned out all to be volunteer psychotherapists from across the nation who were in town working with the children of the police and fire people who live on the two cruise ships.
Do you think that the party will begin again in New Orleans anytime soon?
There's going to be a Mardi Gras, and there's going to be Jazz Fest, and there's live music going on right now every night. Some of the local musicians are back. And it is possible to be in the city and sort of pretend when you're in many of the restaurants that are now reopened and serving fine food, you know, great New Orleans food or in those clubs, that it's New Orleans the way we've always known it. But then you step across a line, whether it's a street or just across a neighborhood, and you see these piles of debris that 2.5 months after Katrina are still there, not removed. And it reminds you of those, if you've made the drive to those huge depopulated areas of the city, that it is not the same New Orleans at all.
Hard time on this Thanksgiving week in New Orleans. Harry Shearer, as always, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Warren.
Renaissance man among entertainers. I'll be right back with an archived edition of To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren, I'll be back with an archived edition of To the Point for Thanksgiving Day. In 30 years since Vice President Johnson's war on poverty, the number of officially poor people in the United States has risen to 37 million. That's comparable to the population of California, biggest state in the Union. Nevertheless, there was a sense of astonishment around the world and here in the U.S. itself at the desperate circumstances of so many people in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Barbara Ehrenreich has written about poverty in America in books like Nickel and Dimed and Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream. Barbara Ehrenreich, welcome.
Glad to be with you, Warren.
Why do you think there was such surprise that there could be such deprivation in America?
Well, it certainly shouldn't be a surprise. I mean, I think there's something strange. You know, we have to keep rediscovering, we being the middle class or the more affluent people, have to keep rediscovering poverty that was, quote, discovered in the early 1960s, which led to the war on poverty. Then it took all those images from New Orleans to remind us that not everybody has a car or a credit card. Have the chance, the ability to evacuate. It should not have been a surprise. Why, you know, we keep repressing this fact. And the sad thing, of course, is this is not a situation that's going to lead to a new war on poverty. In fact, Congress is sharpening its knives right now for deep cuts in food stamps, housing subsidies, just about any program, Medicaid, that the poor benefit from.
All right. We have scheduled to join us in a few moments one of the very high-ranking Republicans in the U.S. Senate. We'll talk to him and ask him whether or not those cuts are intended, including the cuts in income taxes. As well, meantime, Barbara Ehrenreich, what happened to the Great Society and the war on poverty? Is it fair to blame the president, the current president, and the Republicans in Congress?
No, the war on poverty was really undercut years ago by the war in Vietnam. The spending started going toward, more toward the military. And then, you know, ever since then, it's been a story of cuts and more cuts, so that there is very little a very little safety net. And I do want to emphasize that it's not only just sort of long-term, chronically poor people, or just African-American people who are in poverty. Two-thirds of the poor in this country are white, and people are recruited into poverty all the time. That's what my new book, Bait and Switch, is about. From the middle class, when they get laid off, downsized, outsourced out of their once middle-class jobs.
Recruited is an interesting term. Why do you use that?
Well, I was looking just for a word, you know, to say that they're, you know, they're, this is not a problem just of someone else, you know, somebody, those people, somebody presumably different from you and me. This is a threat hanging over really all of us except the very wealthy.
So what does that have to do with the war on poverty? It would seem to me that other issues must be responsible for that.
Well, there are some things that we need right now that would make a huge difference, not only to those who are poor now, but to those who might enter poverty through job loss. And that would be, for example, universal health insurance. It's ridiculous to have health insurance tied to people's place of employment when that's something that changes a lot now for people. We also need longer and more adequate unemployment benefits. Right now, they just don't do the trick. That would make a big difference, not only to Katrina survivors, but to people who get laid off or outsourced.
All right. Your current book, Bait and Switch, which you're talking about now, deals, as you indicated, with, I love the word, recruitment into poverty by people who think of themselves as being in the middle class. What about poverty per se? And it's what does it look like in the United States?
Well, you can walk right by and not see it is one of the problems. If you're in the upper middle class, you may have no contact with people from different classes, except that they, well, obviously they come and probably clean your office at night and probably clean your home. But you probably don't go send your kids to public schools. You probably don't use public transportation. You probably don't go to the clinic on the corner. So you really can live in a very insulated way in this country and not think about the desperation of so many people around you, like the person who cleaned your office at night.
You talked about this being repressed. What do the media have to do with that?
I think they have something to do with it because I've, you know, as a journalist, have tried for decades to get stories about the poor, the working poor, et cetera, into the media. And one of the obstacles is that, especially with the print media, they're very dependent on advertisers. Advertisers want to think they're reaching affluent people, but they call that, quote, good demographics. So media decision makers often interpret that to mean you shouldn't have a lot of coverage of, you know, depressing stories of people who can't even buy the products advertised in the newspaper or magazine anyway.
There are people who say that the face of poverty in America is very different from what it is in the rest of the world. Obviously, as I think you pointed out, not everybody in New Orleans had a car, and particularly the African-American poor people did not. Nonetheless, a lot of people who are still classified as living under the poverty line do have cars, it is argued, and some are said even to own their homes as well. Do you think that's true? Are the poor in America like the third world, as a recent report by the UN claims, or are they in some sort of different sort of kind of intermediate category?
Well, I, you know, changed my mind about this when I was working on Nickel and Dimed about the working poor. I had thought we were in a somewhat, you know, better off situation, even our poor people, than the third world. Then I began to meet homeless people who were full-time workers, people who may have had a car, but for example, but that might be also where they slept. Now, that's getting pretty low. I mean, that's, you can't, nowhere in the world do you get too much lower than that, not having a home.
Once again, we're speaking with Barbara Ehrenreich, who's written a good deal about poverty, most recently Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream, which, as you just described, talks about people now in the middle class who may be at risk of being, as she puts it, recruited into poverty. She's also written in her other book, Nickeled and Dimed, about the people who are poor already. What do you think? We're waiting, as I indicated earlier, for one of the Republicans in the Senate to join us, Rick Santorum, the Republican from Pennsylvania, who has recently released what he refers to as the first and only Republican program for alleviating poverty. That's why we have invited him to be on our program, and we hope very much that he's going to show up. In the meantime, Barbara Ehrenreich, back to the question of politics and whether the Republicans are more or less responsible for this than the Democrats. You said that the war on poverty initially ended up being short-circuited by the war in Vietnam. That was a Democrat war.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't think the Democrats come out exactly spotless in this discussion either. But what we've seen in the last 4 or 5 years of Republican governance is breathtaking, and that is a rapid upward redistribution of wealth as taxes for the rich are cut and any kind of social services for the poor are cut. That's something new on this dramatic scale.
And by upward distribution of wealth, describe how that works, how it happens.
Well, when you cut taxes for the rich and you simultaneously cut say, children's health programs or, you know, heating fuel subsidies for poor families, you know, the money is going out of the pockets of the poor to buy new luxuries for the wealthy.
Once again, Barbara Ehrenreich, author of Bait and Switch and Nickeled and Dimed. As promised, we are joined now by the Republican senator from Pennsylvania, Rick Santorum. And, Senator, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
We very much want to hear in a moment about your proposal, what you describe as the first ever Republican initiative to fight poverty. First, though, let me put to you a question just raised by Barbara Ehrenreich, and that is, will the Republicans in Congress continue with plans to further reduce food stamp programs, housing subsidies, Medicaid, and also tax cuts for those in the upper income brackets? Is that still on the agenda?
Well, with respect to food stamps, I'm not aware of any proposals per se that are going to reduce the food stamp program. There always are, and I think there will be continued attempts to make sure that that program is run efficiently, and hopefully we can do so. But I don't have any plans of reducing or limiting the beneficiaries to that program. I think improving efficiency is something we always strive to do, and the same thing with the Medicaid program. There was a report in the New York Times just a few weeks ago that in New York State alone, they estimate $18 billion, that's with a B, $1 billion in Medicaid fraud. So we've got lots of problems with these programs, and anyone who suggests that when we try to fix those programs that we're cutting benefits, I think it's just, you know, it's just protecting the wasting of government dollars. You know, we can't defend fraud. We can't defend waste and abuse, and those who suggest that when we try to change them that somehow or another we're being cruel, I think what's cruel is taking hard-earned tax dollars and having them go not to help the people who they're intended to help. So we're going to work on those things. I don't see those as cuts. I see those as improvements to a program so we can focus more resources on the people who are actually in need. As far as reductions in taxes are concerned, you know, I'm a strong believer in making sure that we stay competitive economically in this country, and that means that in a world that is ever more globally competitive, we have to make sure that we keep our tax burden at an appropriate level so we can keep jobs here in this country and we can grow the economy. And so part of any future programs have to be looking to make sure that we can stay competitive economically and create jobs here in this country.
Does that include making permanent the cuts in the inheritance tax, the elimination of it?
Well, the death tax is a tax that's a job killer. I mean, the bottom line is that this tax, when imposed on small businesses or family farms and ranches, caused the breakup of businesses, the laying off of employees to pay taxes on someone's estate, you know, whether or someone's ranch or someone's farm. you know, that's for small family businesses, that's devastating. That it doesn't allow businesses to pass from generation to generation. And so people say, oh, that's tough luck. Well, except for the fact that there are employees in that business, and the employees lose their job as a result of the fact that the government has taken the nest egg that these businesses have built up. So I think we're looking at a compromise. I'm hopeful we'll get a compromise that will eliminate the tax on the vast majority of small businesses and farmers and ranchers. I mean, I go throughout Pennsylvania. There are very few big farms left in Pennsylvania simply because farmers have had to sell off pieces of their land as they pass the farm from generation to generation to simply pay the taxes. That makes them smaller, that makes them less efficient, less competitive, and eventually the farmers go out of business. This is not a good idea. This is not good for our agriculture. It's not good for the family farm. It's not good for the rural way of life. So, I'm going to continue to fight for those things to maintain, the middle class.
Okay, Senator, I'm going to interrupt you because we're going to need to go to a break in a moment. I hope you'll be able to stay with us past that, but I want to give you an opportunity to begin to tell us about what you refer to as the first ever Republican initiative to fight poverty. What are the main tenets of that?
Well, it's a variety of things, everything from provisions in there to help charitable organizations to be more active and involved in providing social services to people, which we think is very, very important for the for changing and transforming people's lives. Things from individual development accounts, which are programs that help people save money for go to school, a college, as well as start their own business or home ownership. It's a match savings account for people who put so much, if they put up to $500 a year aside, the federal government will give, in a sense, indirectly through banks, but give a match of up to $500. We have something called Kids Accounts, which is a program that has a match savings account for every child born in America, up to $500 a year. When you're born, you would get this account, so we can begin to develop long-term savings for people. Economic literacy and ownership of assets, we think, are vitally important to transitioning people from a way of life among the poor that is poverty maintenance, instead of trying to lift people up and create more opportunities, particularly to enter into to small businesses and to higher education.
Senator, I'm going to interrupt you. We need to go to a break. I hope you'll stay with us. We'll come back and won't keep you very long, but I'd like to get a bit more of your program and hear you interact with our other guest, Barbara Ehrenreich, before we moved on to another subject. So we'll hopefully be able to do that in a moment. On Reporter's Notebook, the Latin Republic of the United States. On To The Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To The Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To The Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Well, we're not only back with To The Point. Once again, on this archived edition of our program, we're talking about poverty in America. We've asked whatever happened to the war on poverty, established, of course, by Lyndon Johnson back in the 60s. We heard Barbara Ehrenreich, author of Bait and Switch and Nickel and Dimed, say that that fell victim to the war in Vietnam. Many Republicans say that, in fact, what happens with the programs, kinds of programs that are involved there is that they do not work. And as Republican Senator Rick Santorum just said, you end up maintaining poverty instead of lifting people up so they can get out of it. Let me go back to Barbara Ehrenreich and ask you to respond. You said earlier that Republican programs tend to lead to the upward distribution of wealth. What do you think about what we've heard from Senator Santorum?
Well, two points. One is that he talked about the importance of cutting taxes to generate jobs. Sounds good, but right now we have a huge tax cut going on for corporations as they repatriate funds from somewhere else in the world. It's called the American Job Creation Act of 2005. One of the companies getting one of these multi-billion-dollar tax breaks is Hewlett-Packard, which is simultaneously laying off 14,500 people. So I think, you know, we can't keep on coddling the corporations forever in the name of jobs when they may be downsizing at the same time, and the government isn't willing to, doesn't have the spine to stand up to that. The other thing I just have to comment on, though, that as a general thing that Senator Santorum said, is that he described poverty as a sort of a way of life, as if it were some sort of culture that people voluntarily choose to live in. No, poverty is a condition characterized by a lack of money. It comes about either through job loss or through having a job where the wages are too low to actually live on. And in both, you know, what you had in the urban population of New Orleans is you had a lot of people who were service workers making $6, $7, $8 an hour, which are poverty level wages, hard working folks. That's true all over the country. Poverty is not, you know, something wrong with your culture or your mind. It's a matter of being underpaid or having no job at all.
Barbara Ehrenreich. Senator Santorum, back to you. Respond, if you will, on this last point about job loss and poverty wages. Would your program speak to those issues?
What my program talks to, in fact, I lay this out in a book that I wrote called It Takes a Family. And I disagree with Ms. Ehrenreich about what caused the cause of poverty. And I think what we've seen is poverty in this country is principally because of the breakdown of the family within the within these poor communities. And what we need to do is, if you look at across the culture, that, you know, when you have stable families, you have much lower rates of poverty. That's it's just a fact. And so what we've had is government programs that, unfortunately, the left put forward, I think, in good faith. But what happened was a wholesale destruction of the family within particularly the urban core. And I think you see it in many of these communities where you have, generation after generation of single parenthood or in some cases divorce. But in most cases in poverty, it's single parenthood, which is, you know, now in poor communities, 75-80% of children being born are born out of wedlock. And that to me is a problem that the left tends to just ignore and say, well, it's just a matter of, you know, increasing the minimum wage. I'm for increasing the minimum wage, and I've come out in support of that, a dollar increase or $1.10, and I think that will help. But that's not the answer. The answer is we've got to have programs designed around nurturing and supporting families, and that means two-parent, mother and dad, and that means marriage. That means supporting marriage in a deliberate way, having public policy supporting the nuclear family, and those are things that most people on the left simply refuse to do.
Senator, what about what Barbara Ehrenreich referred to as a coddling corporations when Hewlett-Packard stands to gain from the new Job Creation Act, and it's laying people off at the same time?
Yeah, what she didn't say is what would have happened had Hewlett-Packard not been able to take that money back, and how much worse it would have been. The bottom line is that this money was sitting over in foreign countries and was never going to come back, was never going to be reinvested in America. It was going to be reinvested because of the high rates of taxation. It was going to be reinvested in other countries to create jobs in other countries. And that's fine. I mean, we could have kept that money there. What we're suggesting is that I'd rather have that money come back here, be invested here, create American jobs. And, of course, you didn't mention the dozens upon dozens of companies who did bring it back and who did create jobs. In fact, that's one of the requirements under the bill.
Okay. Two very different views of the situation of poverty in the United States and what to do about it from Rick Santorum, Republican senator from Pennsylvania. Thank you very much, Senator, for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And also Barbara Ehrenreich, most recent book, Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream. Thanks, Barbara Ehrenreich, to you for being with us as well.
I've enjoyed it.
The two-thirds of the residents of New Orleans are African Americans, and news reports have made clear that the most desperate victims of Hurricane Katrina were, in fact, African Americans. When Jesse Jackson visited New Orleans and went to the convention center, he said, "This looks like the hull of a slave ship." President Bush denied that there were racial components in terms of who was able to get out of the city and who was left behind. Earl Ofari Hutchinson is a nationally syndicated columnist. He's a radio host, civil rights activist, and author of several books, including The Crisis in Black and Black. Earl Ofari Hutchinson, welcome to you.
Well, always a pleasure.
Crisis in Black and Black, how does that apply to the situation, particularly in New Orleans, that we see now?
Well, we have to ask ourselves, in a city that's had a city government for 30 years, where African Americans have controlled City Hall, the Board of Education, just about all the political positions at City Hall, commissionerships, staff aides, planners, and so forth, where you've had a black police chief, where you've had a black district attorney, again, going back 30 years, we have to ask ourselves, why did you have a situation where two-thirds of New Orleans is certainly prospering, but one-third of New Orleans is in poverty? And, of course, that one-third of New Orleans, as we well know now, is almost exclusively African-American. Now, we know Census Bureau released a report a week before Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, and it's revealed that there are about 40 to 50 million persons in America now that are in poverty. That means about one out of eight Americans are in poverty. We flash back to New Orleans, we see literally in that city a triple poverty figure over the national average, again, primarily African-American, again, in a city that's been controlled politically and to an extent economically by African-Americans. What I'm suggesting is we have seen not only a failure, and we've certainly talked a lot about that with the federal government, what they did or what they didn't do in terms of handling relief, but we also saw something much deeper. We saw a disconnect between African-American politicians, elected officials, civil rights leaders. Apparently they were active in the city, too. At least they had a presence there. And certainly the black middle class. How did that disconnect happen to the point where we've seen so many black poor in a city, essentially, that has prided itself on taking care of at least certain aspects of the African-American population? So there, the breakdown was not just the federal government. The breakdown has been with the black political establishment and, to an extent, the civil rights establishment.
Should point out Earl Ofari Hutchinson is himself African-American. Let me introduce Reverend Graylin Hagler. He is senior minister at the Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ in Washington, D.C., and he's national president of a group called Ministers for Racial, Social, and Economic Justice, which represents about 600 congregations around the country. Reverend Hagler, thank you very much for joining us. Your response, if you will, to what we just heard from Earl Ofari Hutchinson.
Yes, I think that Brother Hutchinson in some ways is correct, and in some other ways I think missed the boat. I mean, correct in terms that there is a disconnect between the established civil rights community and the political leadership and the needs of those who are locked on the bottom, the least of these. But I have to also qualify that with this statement that the fact is that we may be in political leadership such as mayors, et cetera, but the reality is we still do not control the purse strings, the corporate types of purse strings that deliver jobs into local communities. I mean, so that's another issue that I think we have to also be critical of. The fact is, when you talk about oil industry, or if you even want to talk about New Orleans, in New Orleans, for example, years ago you had a casino open wide up, hired a whole bunch of people, then closed its doors and laid them off. That was a corporate enterprise. That was not necessarily a governmental enterprise, or even the governmental agencies had no hand in that, really and truly. So, you know, it is an issue. Yes, there's a disconnect because the leadership has been chasing the American dream and not necessarily talking of making the critical analysis and critiquing the system that keep people poor purposely so that they may be exploited.
Again, Reverend Graylin Hagler, President of Ministers for Racial, Social, and Economic Justice. Back to Earl Ofari Hutchinson, our columnist, a radio host, author of Crisis in Black and Black. How do you respond to the Reverend?
Well, certainly there's agreement on that point about who controls the purse strings, no doubt about that. Certainly, when you're looking at the casinos in New Orleans, I've been there. I've seen how they operate, and I've seen how they don't operate. Oftentimes, they do close, and of course, leave literally hundreds of people. By the way, these are service jobs too, so they're primarily low-paying jobs. We're not talking about top-skilled managerial jobs. Also, Bourbon Street, the Latin Quarter, the French Quarter. I mean, these are tourist things, and certainly that always aligns with the downtown business interests. And as we know, doesn't make any difference whether it's a white mayor or a black mayor. You're going to chase those dollars because that is essentially seen as a key to economic development. Even when it's not a key to economic development, as we saw in New Orleans, primarily low-end service and retail jobs. Now, the other part of that is when we look at the national civil rights leadership, we have to really ask this question. While there has been a great deal of emphasis over the last 20 years on affirmative action, a great deal of emphasis on certainly upwardly mobile, creating more opportunities in corporate America for managers and corporate VPs and executives, primarily African American. When we talk about that disconnect and the lack of a real lobbying effort on the part of mainstream civil rights groups for a poverty agenda in America that addresses directly the problems of the black poor, we see that while these issues are fine, for a certain segment of black America, they simply don't address the deep-seated issues of poverty, which entrap literally millions of African Americans. So that's to suggest this. Without a blueprint, a comprehensive plan, and also even more than that, an active voice for lobbying consistently and sustained for the black poor in America, to me, basically, it's only fulfilling half the picture, success for some in black America and failure for many more in black America.
Reverend Hagler, back to you. Do you think, in order to maintain credibility with their constituents, that the national civil rights leaders, yourself included, ought to be more aggressive, as Earl O'Farrey Hutchinson has indicated, come up with a plan and actively lobby for it?
Well, I think that's important. I mean, we got to look at things like education and the delivery of education so that somebody can compete out there in the job market. That's one aspect. It's also the idea of how do you begin to instill hope in communities where there is a pervasive feeling of hopelessness, where the jobs that you expect to get are the low-paying ones, the housing that you expect to live in are dilapidated, and the type of response that you expect to get from City Hall is lacking. Obviously, we got to continue to take on those issues because in some ways we've gotten too comfortable. We've gotten too comfortable, and we've leaned towards those who have been part of the middle class and the upward mobile of our community, and have focused on their agenda rather than focusing in on the least of these. And I'm one that believes that a rising tide does raise all ships, but you have to start with that at the bottom because then that raises all the ships. But, you know, even more than this, we need to hold federal government accountable in some new ways, accountable in terms of education, accountable in terms of the kinds of job training that takes place. It doesn't mean a matter of testing schools and then taking away money because you got students that don't, in a sense, come up to what you consider the educational standard. That's something that begins to cripple our communities even more. We got to hold government accountable. We got to hold government accountable in its responsiveness. And even in Hurricane Katrina, we got to hold the government accountable in terms of its lack of response and its lack of understanding of the issues and who was going to be caught in the floods. And, you know, my organization right now is saying at the very least, the President of the United States needs to be censored by the United States Congress for that inaction, for appointing political appointees, ones who are not qualified for the job, practicing a form of affirmative action that white folks practice. And obviously, we need to, in a sense, hold the President accountable.
Okay. Again, Reverend Graylin Hagler with the Ministers for Racial, Social, and Economic Justice. Earl O'Farrey Hutchinson, earlier on our program, we heard Barbara Ehrenreich say what I think nobody disputes, and that is that there are, in fact, more white people in America who are in poverty than there are African Americans. Is it important for African American leaders to form coalitions and to are white people doing the same things, white leaders, that you suggest African American leaders have done, mainly getting up and going out and leaving folks behind?
Well, I think it is certainly critical to reach across all color lines. if we go back 35-plus years, we know that Dr. King, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and a number of other organizations got together in Washington, D.C., as a matter of fact, and initiated what they called the Poor People's Campaign. Dr. King didn't just say poverty comes with a black face. He essentially said that the mandate and the mission of the Poor People's Campaign is to essentially reach out to all poor people. It doesn't make any difference what your color is. And I think he understood something, that by just essentially painting it in black, you're missing some things from certainly a public relations standpoint, number one, but even more particularly, number two, from a policy change standpoint. If, in fact, poverty is exclusively seen as coming with a black face, although arguably we know that poverty-wise, more African-Americans disproportionately are in poverty,
sure,
whereas whites certainly numerically are in poverty simply because there are more whites. But at the same time, it's important when you have a Rick Santorum who's put this certainly poverty reduction agenda on the Republican Party's plate and Congress's plate. The only way you're really going to sell this or any other poverty agenda, if in fact those that are pushing it can look and see people that essentially look like them. And I'm talking about racially.
I understand what you're saying. Reverend Hagler, how can that be accomplished? How can you get white politicians to lead the way? Is it by exposing the fact that so many whites are in poverty as well?
Well, I mean, that's part of the race game, though, is that the fact is that they put a black face all the time on poverty so that people do not necessarily feel the panic and the need to move as rapidly on issues as would ordinarily happen. I mean, that's been the old race game that we've played in this country for years. I mean, obviously, that comes back to how you begin to hold politicians accountable. Obviously, we got to confront people. I can give you a recent example when I was dealing with stuff around predatory lending and went up on the Hill to talk to some folks who were working on bills around predatory lending, and we had a number of constituents that were engaged in and being defrauded of their homes, and the aide said to me, they said, Reverend, we understand and it'll work, but I tell you what, you got to bring me some white faces. I don't want to see any black faces in order for us to take this issue seriously. It shows us how we got to continue to confront folks about race and their use of race, as well as the fact that to point out the images of those who are white and in poverty.
Once again, this has been an archived edition of To the Point. Thanks so much to Reverend Graylin Hagler, Senior Minister at the Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ in Washington, D.C., National President of Ministers for Racial, Social, and Economic Justice, again representing 600 congregations around the country. Thanks also to Earl Ofari Hutchinson, nationally syndicated columnist, radio host, civil rights activist, and author of The Crisis in Black and Black, among other books. And thanks to our earlier guests as well, Senator Rick Santorum and Barbara Ehrenreich. This year, Latinos became the largest minority in the United States. There are thriving communities that speak Spanish, not just in L.A., New York, and Miami, but in the Midwest, the Great Plains, and the Deep South. In a moment, a writer who says they'll continue to speak Spanish and to change America for a long time to come on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
We're Roman Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. A new book called Translation Nation argues that America's fast-growing Hispanic population constitutes a Latin Republic of the United States. Hector Tobar is the son of immigrants from Guatemala. He's also a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Hector, thanks a lot for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Warren.
In your book, you define a concept you call Americanismo. What is that?
Oh, it's the idea that just because you've come to the north of the border and that you've planted your roots in the United States and you've taken the oath as an American citizen and you see your future in the United States, it doesn't mean that you have turned your back on your Latin American identity, and that in your family life and in your civic life, you do everything you can to keep that identity alive, whether it's speaking Spanish at home to your children or taking part in a Latino civic institution like a soccer league, or helping to organize a Cinco de Mayo parade, and many of the myriad institutions that are now sort of a feature of not just California life, but increasingly of small-town life in the United States.
Is this different from the pattern of previous migration into the United States?
Well, I would argue that it is, just for the simple fact of the proximity of Mexico and Central America and the way in which those countries, especially and also Cuba and Puerto Rico, are integrated with the United States. You know, it wasn't possible for the mythical Vito Corleone to get on a bus every summer to go back to Corleone, you know, to go see his family. He came and pretty much established himself in New York, you know. But the average Mexican immigrant, if he lives in Memphis or if he lives in Los Angeles or in Dalton, Georgia or Rupert, Idaho, will very often Christmas time pack up his stuff in his pickup truck and drive south of the interstate system, go visit his family, have a nice Christmas meal and celebrate all the Christmas rituals of Mexican and Central American life, and then get back in that car and drive back and bring back lots of pictures with him and start thinking about what he's going to do the next year. So there's this sort of like back and forth interchange between the two cultures that I think is much, much different from any previous migration in American history.
But there are a lot of cultures involved here. There are countries in South America, Central America, Mexico, all of whom think of themselves as different from one another, just as we think of ourselves as different from Canadians. Do they see a link between one another that qualifies all of them for what you refer to as Americanismo?
Well, I would say that in the first months, the first years in which someone arrives, that national identity and the idea that you are, if you're a Guatemalan, you're different from a Salvadoran. And you know, I grew up as a Guatemalan American, and you know, I learned all of the prejudices my father had against the different Central American nationalities, and I won't go into them. But I think that the longer you live in a place, the more you're thrown together with other people who, what you have in common with them is the fact that you speak Spanish, that you sort of discover your commonalities. And, you know, I've discovered many, many pan-Latino cultures where people from different nationalities are thrown together. You see that in Los Angeles and New York and Miami, of course, where Peruvians and, you know, Brazilians even and Argentines and Cubans are thrown together. But one of the ones that I found that was most interesting was in Clay County, Georgia, where I had once worked in a chicken factory. And I went back there as I was wrapping up, you know, my manuscript, Translation Nation, and I found in this little town where I had worked in the chicken plant that there were a couple of Cuban guys who had come across the ocean and had been detained in Guantanamo. There was a guy from Los Angeles who was a Mexican-American who had sort of decided to seek better fortunes. There was a woman from Chiapas who had crossed with her daughters. There were Puerto Ricans. There were Panamanians. And they all sort of, you know, lived together in this little town, and they all sort of were thrown together in terms of having to face this sort of alien world, because it's a very for them, it's a, you know, very Baptist, very rural, very, very different place that isn't, wants them to work there, but in some cases doesn't really accept them, and so they have this common adversity that they share. So after a while, I think those different national identities become sort of more molded into this pan-Latino idea.
If they don't intend to assimilate, if they're going to continue to speak Spanish, what do you think is going to be the impact on the whole of American culture?
Well, I think people, it's not necessarily they don't want to assimilate and learn English. It's that they don't want to lose their Spanish. They don't want to lose their Southern sense of themselves.
Assimilating at the same time, then, that they're maintaining their cultural identity?
Right. I think that there is, it's a paradox, because even the people who, even if you just look at the population that comes to the United States, like in my own family, the ones who leave tend to be the most ambitious ones in a family. My father is much more ambitious than my uncle, who stayed behind and has never really liked coming to the United States and has made his life in Guatemala, because it's a little bit easier life than coming to the States and uprooting yourself and having to deal with American culture, which, you know, is very, very ambitious, very fast-moving. And so I think that people who come here hunger for that. They hunger for that sort of American social mobility that everyone has always hungered for who's come here, whether it be from Italy or Romania or whatever. But at the same time, I just think it's becoming easier for people to keep to create institutions that have a Latin American character to them, whether it be a soccer league, whether it be a union movement. There are many union activists operating across the United States in many small towns, meat processing plants, or in big towns like Los Angeles, and hotel workers movement, who bring their traditions of union, you know, activism. And with each generation, what happens is that Latin American part of their identity becomes more self-confident. And so while they're not completely turning their back on the American dream, in fact, not at all, I would say, because they still want their kids to go to college, they want to sort of create that sort of Latin American sense of themselves where they're living now.
All right. Hector Tobar, the book is Translation Nation, Defining a New American Identity in the Spanish-Speaking United States. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you so much, Warren.
We're hoping you are having a happy Thanksgiving Day. Our producers of To the Point are Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Katie Cooper, Ileana Justice, Jonah King, and Sharon Rimbaugh, managing producer Karen Radziner. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. The technical director is Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warman Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.